This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The death penalty remains a controversial and divisive issue. Last month, just before leaving office, Illinois Governor George Ryan took a stand by pardoning four condemned men and commuting the sentences of the remaining 167 prisoners on Illinois' death row. 2 years earlier, the governor imposed a moratorium on executions and appointed a commission to examine the fairness of the death penalty. The commission released its findings last April and recommended 80 changes in the way the death penalty is administered. Later, we'll hear from a state's attorney who served on the commission and continues to support the death penalty. First, we'll talk about serving on the commission with Scott Turow. Turow is a lawyer and the author of several best-selling legal thrillers, including Presumed Innocent. His latest novel, Reversible Errors, is about a lawyer trying to exonerate a man facing imminent execution. Here's our interview with Scott Turow on the death penalty.
I know that when I was asked to protest the execution of John Wayne Gacy, who had killed 33 young men in the most horrible means imaginable, and then buried their tortured bodies under his house, that I refused to join in the protest. I couldn't call executing Gacy an injustice. So I was never settled in my own mind, though, whether capital punishment, while just in terms of my own moral lexicon, whether it was wise as a matter of legal procedure and a way to run a society.
Now, when you were prosecuting cases, there was no federal death penalty at the time, and you were a federal... federal assistant U.S. attorney.
Correct.
But then you became a defense attorney.
Right.
With a private practice, and by this
right.
time there was a death penalty. Did you have cases in which were capital cases in which you were defending the person?
Well, my exposure to capital punishment really came in a couple of doses. For many years, I represented a man named Alex Hernandez, who, along with his more celebrated co-defendant, Rolando Cruz, had been tried, convicted, and sentenced to death once. Their case was reversed, and Cruz was retried, sentenced to death again, Hernandez to 80 years. And I came in at the point that Hernandez had been sentenced to 80 years. So I was handling the appeal from a capital prosecution, but my client was not death sentenced. His co-defendant was. The great controversy came after both Hernandez and Cruz had been convicted and sentenced to death when another man, Brian Dugan, confessed that he, in fact, had committed the crime for which these two men were then on death row, a claim in Dugan's case that was obviously buttressed by the fact that he had committed other murders, one of which nearly identical to the crime involved for Cruz and Hernandez. And the response of the prosecutors to this new information about Dugan was certainly disappointing to me as a defense lawyer. They resisted Dugan's confession for a decade, attempting to debunk it, calling him a liar when they couldn't prevail any longer on the idea that he was uninvolved because of DNA tests. Then they started to suggest that Cruz and Hernandez must have committed the crime with him. And as I say, it was a classic example of watching prosecutors get dug into a theory and then basically losing, in my opinion, any sense of boundary in trying to vindicate that original judgment.
So what was the final outcome in this case?
Well, the final outcome is complicated, but the short answer is that Cruz and Hernandez are free. Seven individuals, four police officers and three prosecutors, were indicted for conspiring to obstruct justice in the Cruz case. They were tried and they were acquitted, but the county reached a multimillion-dollar civil settlement with Hernandez, Cruz, and their one-time co-defendant, a man named Stephen Buckley, who'd been indicted with them originally.
So was this case a turning point for you in terms of your opinions about the death penalty?
The case was a turning point for me in my opinions about the justice system. Like most people who have been prosecutors, I always assumed that I had certainly never taken anybody to trial whom I thought was innocent. And I really believe that the justice system operated, perhaps not perfectly, but I thought it was extremely unlikely that you could convict an innocent person, let alone once. But the idea that it could be done twice seemed completely ridiculous and inconceivable to me. And I think there's, you know, something in the nature of the kinds of cases that end up as capital cases, cases in which the death penalty is sought, that makes them more prone to convict innocent people.
What is that?
It's sort of a paradox that troubles the capital system. The cases in which capital punishment is supposed to be sought are, you know, to borrow an often used phrase most recently employed by the Virginia prosecutor who's trying the Beltway sniper case, it's supposed to be the worst of the worst. These are the most offensive, most repellent crimes whose facts are often deeply upsetting. In the case of Hernandez and Cruz, a 10-year-old girl had been abducted from her home in broad daylight, sexually abused, and then beaten to death. And the problem is that these cases stir up deep anxieties and enormous anger. And that combination of anxiety and anger puts pressure on police and prosecutors to come up with suspects, and also makes it hard for judges and juries to make dispassionate decisions in these cases. And the irony is that the worse the case, the more likely you are, the way our system operates, to convict innocent people.
What are some of the things that you saw when you served on the Governor's Commission investigating the death penalty that affected your point of view about the death penalty?
Well, you know, in this state, we've now had 17 people who have been sentenced to death and later legally absolved, in most cases with convincing proof of innocence. And you really sit back and you go, how could this happen and how could it happen so often? And certainly the largest problem is the one that I just identified, at least in my opinion, which is that, you know, the cases themselves are basically a trap for the innocent because they're so emotional. But beyond that, in these 17 cases in Illinois, the certainly most prevalent problem was what you'd have to call false confessions. You know, as a prosecutor, I sort of subscribed to the belief that nobody would ever confess to a crime they didn't commit. And it turns out that there are various circumstances where that does happen.
You mean because it's beaten out of them?
Well, you know, beating is one thing. You know, Gary Gauger, though, who's one of the 13, or one of the now 17, excuse me, but Gary Gauger, whose case is dramatized in the play The Exonerated, Gauger found the bodies of his parents and was immediately taken by the police as a suspect. He was then interrogated for 12 hours, and in that state of mind began speculating about how the crime might have occurred, and the police treated that as a confession. So you're really looking at interrogation techniques there that risked false statement. That happened more than once. That was certainly something that was true in Hernandez's case as well. You know, he made constant wild statements. Alex's IQ was debated, but nobody thought it was much above 80. And he was constantly put in circumstances where he was trying to help the police and saying absolutely goofy things, but the police ultimately picked and chose among those statements and said, well, this proves that he's guilty.
You pointed out that some people support the death penalty because it suits their sense of moral proportion, that a serious and heinous, repulsive crime, a monstrous offense, should also have the most severe penalty,
right?
Execution. But after research and after serving on this commission, I think you no longer think that that sense of moral proportion really holds up.
The problem with it is that you can't carry it out in practice. It puts an enormous burden of precision on the justice system. If you sentence to death people who are not guilty or whose crimes are less grave than other people who get life sentences, for example, then you have not reinforced any kind of proportionate morality. You've undermined it. And in point of fact, that's exactly what we do. Certainly, we did commission research in Illinois that showed differential treatment, for example, not just based on race, which is a complicated subject, but geography, gender. All of these things change the rates at which people get sentenced to death, and certainly race is another factor, although it doesn't operate so much on the skin color of the defendant so much as on the skin color of the victim. But again, if you kill a white person in this society, or at least in the state of Illinois historically, you're 3.5 more times likely to get a death sentence than if you kill somebody black.
And if you kill them in a rural area, you're more likely to get the
death
penalty
more
than
likely
in the
city. 5 times more likely in a rural area. I think it's 2.5 more times likely if you kill a woman, half as likely if you are a woman. All of these factors play in, and you think that it's ultimate punishment for ultimate evil, but it ends up being far more capricious than that.
Well, one of the problems with the system is that people who have been convicted turned out to not have done the murder, and one of the reasons why we know that is that after the fact, DNA has been used in the reinvestigation of certain cases, and
right.
It's shown that the person who was found guilty didn't do the crime. So in the short term, DNA evidence is an argument against the death penalty because we're proving that people were unjustly convicted. You could argue that in the long term, DNA evidence will help support the death penalty because now we'll be more certain that the people convicted of a crime actually did the crime. Do you think that your point of view about the death penalty will change as DNA becomes more widely used?
Well, I think that the argument you just made is unfortunately specious. DNA has sort of exposed the tip of the iceberg. It has shown us that in many, many cases of violent crime, these kinds of cases that excite the emotions, we've convicted the wrong people. The Central Park jogger case is, you know, an example from outside of Illinois. But lay people tend to make the assumption that, well, you have DNA in every case. In point of fact, you do not have DNA in every case. Generally speaking, there's not always genetic evidence left behind. It's got to be blood, saliva, semen, something like that. So while DNA is exposed in a really troubling way, the fallacies of the system, it is not the case that we're going to be able to tell innocent from guilty simply because of that scientific innovation or any other. To a great extent, the system still depends upon the testimony of eyewitnesses, of accomplices. Those are the means we've got. And I'm not proposing that we shut down the criminal justice system, but we have to be aware of its vagaries.
Do you think that the death penalty has looked different to you from the point of view of prosecutor than it's looked from the point of view of defense attorney?
Sure. I mean,
what are some of the differences?
Well, bear in mind, and I try to remind myself of this all the time, and we talk appropriately about the propensity of the innocent to be convicted in capital cases. But the reality, of course, is that most defendants who are convicted in the United States are still guilty. And when you are a prosecutor, your day-to-day experience is not of struggling to convict the innocent, but, of course, struggling against all of the barriers that the system imposes to convict the guilty. But when you get on the other side and you're suddenly charged with dealing with an individual case, of course, it can look much different. And one of the real problems we've got in this country is that we're basically, especially in our big cities, engaged in a system of wholesale justice.
What do you mean by wholesale justice?
The demands on the system are huge. You go into, for example, a courtroom in the state courts in Chicago. Every judge has got 100 active criminal cases on his docket, at least 100. Many of them involving lots of serious violence. You can't take all those cases to trial. You have to get guilty pleas. There's a tremendous impetus to sort of push those cases through the system. By the same token, we can sit and talk about DNA and scientific evidence, but if you're a police officer who's dealing with crime by volume, the easiest way to clear a case is to get a confession, not to go out and take DNA specimens and wait 6 weeks for the results to come back. And in that context, if there's a premium, for example, on confessions, and there is, that's an obvious temptation to employ over-aggressive means in getting those confessions.
The Commission to Reform the Death Penalty that you served on at the request of Governor Ryan of Illinois issued a bunch of recommendations. Select what you consider to be the most important ones.
Well, there were several. The big-ticket items in my mind, though, are videotaping of interrogations. That means that as soon as somebody is a suspect in a murder, that everything the police do with that person in the station house is videotaped, so that that eliminates both the coercion and the claims of coercion. We recommended greatly reducing the eligibility factors in Illinois. When the death penalty was passed here in 1977, there were 7 factual circumstances under which capital punishment could be sought. There are now 20, and one of them, felony murder, has gone from 9 felonies that made you eligible to 16. We recommended dramatically reducing that number and getting rid of felony murder. We recommended a statewide commission review the election of any of the 102 state's attorneys in Illinois who have the power now to seek the death penalty. We did that to make sure that there was better uniformity in the way that laws are applied, so you don't get the death penalty being sought 5 times more often in rural areas. We recommended changing the way eyewitness identifications and lineups are conducted. And then we also sort of said to the people of Illinois, if you want to have a death penalty, you must be willing to pay for it. The fact of the matter is that capital punishment is more expensive than the alternatives. You have to be willing to fund defenses, and the state has made a good start in that direction. You have to have qualified lawyers who, generally speaking, require compensation. You have to have experts. You have to have psychologists. Your state has to pay for that in most instances. You have to have better training for police, for judges, for defense lawyers.
It's interesting that you say that, because I think most people assume if you kill the offender, it's cheaper than maintaining them in prison.
Right. Just one of many false assumptions about the death penalty. This has been studied in a number of different jurisdictions. The most recent one was done in our neighboring state of Indiana, where they figured that in terms of present dollars, it's about 35% more expensive to impose a capital sentence on somebody.
Have you spent much time on death row?
Well, I've certainly been there, yeah. You know, I don't know what qualifies as much time, but I've probably visited death row 10, 12 times, and, you know, I've stood in the execution chamber where it now stands in Illinois. So I've been there, yes.
What were your reasons for standing in the execution chamber, and what was the impact of that on your thinking?
Well, the execution chamber I wanted to see as a member of the commission. I've never seen an execution. I was grateful, frankly, that I didn't have the opportunity while I was sitting on the commission, because I probably would have forced myself to take advantage of it. But I wanted to go to the death chamber in Illinois to get to just sort of confront this, because the fact of the matter is that this is an enormously cruel punishment as it is imposed. You take people who've done in many, many instances, unspeakable things. But they have been subdued at that point. Many of them actually changed their behavior in the structure of a prison environment. And, you know, you take a subdued, captured individual and kill them. And it's deeply unsettling to the correctional officers who are involved in this. And that's not to gainsay their belief in capital punishment. I think for most of them, they do believe in what they're doing.
I know one of the people you visited on death row was Henry Brisbon. Who is he? Why'd you visit him?
Well, Henry Brisbon tends to be the poster child for capital punishment in Illinois. When you talk to law enforcement professionals, people in the correctional system, prosecutors, police officers, they always point to Brisbon because in addition to having been convicted twice of murder, one set of serial murders and another prison murder, he's got an atrocious disciplinary record, over 250 disciplinary incidents, many of them involving serious acts of alleged violence, stabbings, hitting correctional officers with 2x4s, throwing a 30-pound dumbbell against the head of another inmate, severely injuring him, at least according to the prison officials' allegations. So he is somebody whose propensity to violence and to murder is very well demonstrated, and certainly if you're going to execute anybody, somebody who is a sort of living threat ought to be at the top of the list. So I wanted to meet Brisbon, but more important, look at the Supermax facility at TAMS, the southern part of Illinois, just to see if it really was possible to restrain the likes of Brisbon with conditions of confinement. In other words, because if you can't, I was prepared to say that execution in those cases really seems to me to be just, and if not inevitable.
So did you feel he was adequately controlled at this prison?
My judgment, and based really on talking with the correctional officials I did, was that the risks are enormously mitigated. Somebody with the kind of track record that Brisbon has is not someone with whom correctional officers are ever comfortable saying he'll never kill again. But they acknowledge that the odds are dramatically reduced, and certainly they're reduced enough that they're comfortable walking into the institution every day. So I think in practical terms, supermax confinement, which is very, very rugged,
Why don't you describe how that applies to Brisbon's situation? What was the supermax aspects of it? What kind of...
Well, supermax is what it means. Generally speaking, prisoners in the TAMS facility and other supermaxes across the United States are permitted no flesh-to-flesh contact with other human beings. That means if things go as intended, once you are sent to a supermax and until you are allowed to leave there, you never touch another human being. In Illinois, they are in cells with a punch plate front, which prevents them from being able to put their hands between bars and do any mayhem that way. It's a small box of preformed concrete. I've forgotten the dimensions exactly. I'd say roughly 8x10. There's almost nothing in there except a single fixture, which is a combination toilet and sink, and a foam mattress over a concrete pallet. Once a day, for about 45 minutes, the door is opened by remote control. You can go out down the end of the galleyway to another remote control door and take fresh air. Then you go back to your cell, and five times a week you also get 15 minutes to shower. And the cell itself, as I said, is there is a single window which is up high. It's very narrow. This is not comfortable living in any way, shape, or form.
John Ashcroft is insisting that federal prosecutors seek the death penalty in some cases where the prosecutors had not sought it or had recommended against it. And this is mostly going on in the Northeast, New York, I think Connecticut is the other
state.
Right. What's your interpretation of what Ashcroft is doing and why he's doing it?
I think the Attorney General can look at what's happening and realize that the death penalty is not being sought by federal prosecutors on a reasoned and consistent basis. And so he's forcing them to apply it more often in the hope that it will become more reasonable and more consistent. And this is a fairly typical response. It's where Illinois was after the reenactment of the death penalty in 1977. And the result is you become over-inclusive in the application of the death penalty. You begin applying it, in point of fact, to cases where subordinate prosecutors have said the death penalty ought not be applied. How that ends up being more just is really confounding to me. You force the line prosecutor's hand, say, you've got to seek death in this case, and the line prosecutor is already on the record saying, well, we shouldn't do it. And again, I don't know if that makes the people who are listening here feel more confident about the application of the death penalty.
Now that we're facing terrorisms and trials of people accused of terrorism, is your thinking related to terrorism and the death penalty any different from your thinking pertaining to criminal trials, basic criminal trials and the death penalty?
Well, you know, when you say the state should not kill, the next question is, well, what do you do about war? And I do accept war as inevitable. As a lawyer, I say that the issue of capital punishment is whether the state should kill its own citizens, not whether it should kill its foreign enemies. Sometimes it has to do that, and for that reason, I draw a lawyerly distinction between domestic crime and acts of foreign terrorism.
So you could endorse a death penalty for foreign terrorists who've committed actions against the United States sooner than for American criminals?
I think the question of whether we execute Osama bin Laden is a much different question than whether we execute the people on our death rows.
Now that you've served on the commission to reform the death penalty, is the kind of case that you want to take on different?
Well, actually, my own desire is I want to get out of the world of capital punishment, both as a writer and as a lawyer for a while. It's very, very consuming emotionally. And I would like to move on into other matters.
Yeah, your new novel has to do with capital punishment.
Right.
And is that a result of having served on this commission? Which came first, Reversible Errors, your new novel, or the commission?
No, actually, the Reversible Errors was the one impediment to my accepting a place on the commission when it was suggested that I might be considered. Because I'd already started the novel, and that sprang from 10 years of experience as a lawyer involved with capital prosecutions, and ultimately I think we all sat down and figured, well, there is no actual conflict here. But I resolved personally that I wouldn't publish Reversible Errors until after the commission had issued its report.
Well, Scott Turow, thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Scott Turow is a lawyer and best-selling novelist. His latest legal thriller is called Reversible Errors. Coming up, we talk with Lake County, Illinois State's Attorney Michael Waller, who also served on the commission to investigate the fairness of the death penalty. He continues to support capital punishment.